Welcome to another exciting episode of the NIDS View, a weekly show of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies, where we are advancing peace, promoting stability, and helping you to think deterrence. Each week, we discuss and analyze a recent topic and provide insight into how it affects our national deterrence. We hope you enjoy this show.
Welcome back to another great episode of the NIDS View, a podcast of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies. Of course, I'm Adam Lowther, and today Jim Petrosky is back with us. And Curtis is gone this week. He's, getting his yard ready for the winter or something like that. But we're joined by Rob Kittinger, who's one of our senior fellows at NIDS. And Rob sent me a message a week or two ago and said, hey, I've got a great topic for a podcast, and you guys should have a podcast on it. And I said, well, it's your topic. You brought it up. So now you've got to come on the show, and you've got to talk about it. So, of course, Rob is here. And I said, Rob, you've got to introduce the topic and kick us off. So, Rob, welcome into
thanks, Adam. That was so kind of you, and happy to be here on NIDS. So I ran across some papers on transparent ocean. And just to explain what that is, transparent ocean is the idea that there is some new technology that comes out that then makes submarines visible to other militaries around the world. And that might involve neutrinos or bubble trails or super sensitive magnets or whatever it involves. But the problem with that is that our triad, we've got, you know, silos, airplanes, and submarines. The submarines are supposed to be the most survivable leg of the triad. When they, in this transparent ocean scenario, they are no longer survivable. They could be attacked during the first strike, or they can even be attacked prior to the first strike. Maybe one or two of them get taken out through some surreptitious means. And all of that affects our ability to have a credible deterrence to keep our near peer, China, Russia type countries, deterred from using nuclear weapons against the United States. So the whole idea that kind of came to me while reading these articles is, how do we as a nation start thinking about what does deterrence theory look like in this world where transparent ocean exists? How do we start planning for it today so that we're ready when this technology does emerge? I think this is one of those things that's kind of termed tech surprise. And, that's it makes us nervous when these types of technology can kind of pop up overnight. And about a year and a half ago is when these articles came out. So it really could be moving along, whether it takes 10 years or 5 years or whatever. So that's the problem space I'd like to talk about.
Yeah, it's interesting. You sent me a couple of articles, one of them from the South China Morning Post and one from a website called Interesting Engineering. And apparently Chinese researchers had published some peer-reviewed journal articles where they had conducted some studies, and they found that U.S. submarines, when moving at high speed, because of the cavitation bubble they produce, give off an electromagnetic signature that you really can't get rid of. You can, if they're sitting still or moving slowly, it doesn't produce it, but if they're moving at speed, it does. And the Chinese researchers said, hey, we can detect that bubble. And then, of course, there's also, I've read some stuff. If we were to have quantum computing and, let's say, OPIR satellites, overhead persistent infrared, looking down on oceans, that because of the fidelity of that quantum computing, they can parse data, parse images with such fidelity that they could see, slight differences in the ocean's temperature, or they could see slight movement below the ocean surface. And so, there were these things that could make oceans transparent. And then, of course, there's the old technique, which I don't think we most Americans and most of our listeners don't really know, but there were a couple incidences during the Cold War, and these incidences are talked about in some books that are available, some older books, where Los Angeles, it happened both an LA class attack sub was sitting outside a Soviet pen and started following an American sub. That sub thought it detected an American one. It, you know, it slowed down and then the Americans rammed them. And then there's another instance in which it was essentially the Soviet sub sitting outside the you know, in Scotland, you know, the Soviet pens in the UK or the submarine pens in the UK. And essentially there was another collision. So there's sort of old fashioned ways to do it. And then we've never talked about, you know, UUVs that could sit and wait, you know, so there's all this new technology. So it's not just transparency. It's all kinds of things that can make being a submarine our, you know, sort of our fewest in number and most expensive nuclear leg could be sort of at risk from any one of these technological surprises, which sort of gets at your point about like, what do we do if any of those things happen? So Jim, what's your take on all of this?
Well, yeah, my first thing, most people know I own a farm, so I'm going to say, whoa, let's just slow down here a little bit. Okay. So, you know, if you read the articles, they say, well, these signals come off and they could be measured, these electromagnetic signals from these bubbles. So we're talking about a future technology. I agree with Rob. We're very proud to have people like him associated with us that are deep thinkers about deterrence. And the whole concept here, and I like the way Rob phrased it, is we need to think of the emerging technologies and how they will affect deterrence. And I like that view because that's what we should be doing. We should try to stay ahead so we don't get surprised. So now let's take a look at this. So first of all, Adam, you bring up the fact that in the past, you know, early submarines, they got detected because they made a lot of noise. And so they tried to make them quieter so you couldn't sneak up on them, or you know, you could hear them using the sonic signals underground. And then we went to, you know, we went to heat signatures coming off the engines because they left a heat signature, and that hot moist water would be there leaving a trail behind a submarine. And so we worked on that. And my point is that every one of these problems we found solutions for. And so now is the time to think of what are the solutions. For example, I look at it first of all from an operational standpoint. We know what we have in terms of our submarines. We know what kind of signals they give off. So operationally, we also know that if you're looking at bubble cavitation and a frequency is coming from that, when a submarine's not moving, it is no longer bubble cavitating. I don't know if that's a word or not. I just made it up. So I'll claim that as mine. Okay, bubble cavitating. And operationally, we can figure out ways of hiding or you know, maneuvering submarines in places where they may not be detected operationally. The real question is, how does that change our reliance on our triad? And that's the, you know, that's the interesting piece. We've talked before in this podcast about, you know, what is an important piece of the triad? Well, the, you know, the obviously the ICBMs, you know, the missile leg, you know, that's important, but we often overlook the bomber component to the triad and say maybe we become more reliant on the bombers and less reliant on the submarines, or maybe we come up with a new technology to stealthily sneak a nuclear weapon some other way. I don't know. There are other technologies that are emerging. So before I run for the hills, I'd like to ask Rob, since you've studied this a bit, you know, these emerging technologies will change us operationally. What can we do today in order to change this sort of output that's going to affect us from an, you know, from a deterrent standpoint? So I'm going to turn back to you, Rob.
Before you get into that, Rob, I don't know if you knew this, Jim, but the reason that Rob is a big into deep thoughts is because when he was younger, he, you know, his hero was Jack Handy, and he used to watch Deep Thoughts by Jack Handy every week. And so he said, I want to have deep thoughts too. And so that's, you know, that's really what led him to be the deep thinker that he is. So
I have no idea the context here. Is this another TV thing, Adam?
This is a
Saturday Night Live. Or?
It's a Saturday Night Live skit, Jim. Deep Thoughts by Jack Handy.
Never heard it.
I would attempt to do the voice, but I'm going to spare everyone.
That's all right. Adam's done enough Saturday Night Live references in this show to fill an entire show, and we'll just leave it at that. Go ahead, Rob.
Yeah, so I think there's a few things that we could start doing today, but I think they're, you know, number one, I think we just need to start having discussions and talking about problem spaces like this, problem spaces like hyper accuracy with our ICBM capabilities and our rivals' ICBM capabilities. So, you know, that's just another problem for another show. But, you know, when you start trading, you know, 2-for-1 silo and you go down to 1-for-1 silo, it changes the math a lot. And so I think that's another problem space we need to be talking about. And I think, you know, the Chinese ramp up also on their silo production and missile ICBM production also kind of matches the same deterrence calculus. We're not just, I guess my point is that we're not just facing one problem in deterrence kind of changing the landscape at once, but this is happening in a changing landscape of many different changes. It's much more dynamic than it has been for the last 30 years. So we could start having things that, you know, dummy submersibles that are creating cavitation bubbles. That might be one type of technology we look into to kind of create noise. You know, when they're looking for that signal, give them more noise. We could be, you know, today we could increase our bomber posture. I think that's an absolute. I think going to more bombers makes a lot of sense. I think we could go to a ICBM launch on warning doctrine. Yes, that destabilizes the world. That does put the world at more risk. But when you can't count on survivability and having that second strike, you have to start thinking about launch on warning. And so, you know, increased role for stealth bombers. Yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, the B-21 Raider could play a big part of that. And then let's see. The other one that I kind of like, and I was thinking about, and it's an old idea, but we can also harden our silos, right? We can have rail mobile silos that are inside of mountains, and you know, instead of being buried straight under the surface, they kind of pop out from the side of a mountain and you know, could launch from there. So that's technology that we looked at, I think, probably in the 60s. But that would be a very survivable second strike capability that we could maintain even in a transparent ocean environment.
Yeah, there. You know, that's an. I hadn't thought about submersibles, essentially decoys. I mean, we think about decoys when we think about ICBMs and, you know, how do you? Yeah, how do you create? Make it harder for, you know, your air defenses or whatever else you might use. You know, the Russians had nuclear tipped air defenses over Moscow. So how do you make that more difficult to hit your actual reentry vehicle? So submarines is kind of a, you could also, you know, I like nuclear weapons on surface ships and mm-hmm. putting and dispersing it. So, and you know, one of the things is it's almost like when you go to a, you know, America is a lot like the Houston Astros. They're champions. God. They're just champions, and they win a lot, and they win over and over and over. And so one of the things we could do, speaking of a baseball reference, is, you know, everybody remembers when you go to a baseball game and they have like the three baseball helmets and then the ball's under one and then they start shifting them all around. Well, you can think about nuclear weapons that way in the sense where you don't quite know which ship your nuclear weapons are on. Therefore, you make it hard to track, you know, mobile ICBMs. You know, we did studies where we dropped ICBMs out of, you know, out of C-17s and C-5s, I think. And, you know, and that's actually a really feasible thing you could do. And you can't, while they are ballistic, if you're dropping them out from unexpected locations, you can't really pre-plan that ballistic trajectory. And so there's all these kind of interesting things that you can do to just really make things more complicated because you're right. There's, you know, the Russians and the Chinese are really thinking about how do we take out this submarine fleet? And I wonder why sort of the arms control and disarmament community persistently says, let's make it even easier for the Russians and the Chinese by going to one delivery system.
Yeah.
And let's allow them to focus their efforts and their funding on targeting one delivery system. To me, that just doesn't make sense. But for the arms control community, it seems to make sense.
Yeah, Adam. Yeah, I this interesting. I think we were sort of pointing at a couple of things that I was thinking about before we got into this, because I was thinking instead of targeting the thought of what about this cavitation bubble and how it will make the oceans invisible, let's look at all the other options that are on the table that we can do right now. And that's why I thought this was a good part for the discussion. Before I go though, Adam, I will say I'm still lost on your Saturday Night Live thing. And I'm lost on the baseball thing you said when you were at a baseball game. I was going to go to a baseball game once, but I believe I was studying for a calculus examination. And so that takes a little more effort than watching a ball game. But anyway, this subject. The other place I think that we have that we could target or see is if these are sensitive magnetic detectors. Okay, their proximity to the submarines is probably going to be very small because, this is a very small electromagnetic signal. Electromagnetic signals drop off as 1/r squared spherically, plus there's some atmospheric interference. There's actually an exponential decay to that as well. So you get the closer you are, the more probable it is to detect. So, I imagine at least the initial structure of these going to have to be on surface ships looking around. If you look at surface ships or satellites that are searching for submarines, their satellites are, pretty easy targets, especially if they're at low Earth orbit. And they probably would need to be something out, 500, 600 kilometers in the sky, probably not going to see anything but a little dot called the Earth down there underneath. And, it's going to be hard to sort that out on the ocean. And doubtful that it can sort that out. So, I mean, I'm not saying it can't be done. I sort of like the neutrino idea, Rob, because we've already looked at neutrinos for detecting caves, and people say it couldn't be done. And people started finding it useful for mines and also for oil fields, et cetera. Those are real things that can happen, and they're very hard to interfere with because the neutrinos don't really interfere with anything. They're hard. That's why they're hard to detect. But there are ways to do that. And so, maybe the detection systems and the systems where we're going to be looking for submarines might be part of the scheme for ensuring that our oceans do not become transparent. Any thoughts on that, Rob?
Yeah, you mentioned the neutrinos, neutrino detection, hypersensitive magnetic detection. Another one that I've heard about recently is just using the background radiation of the Starlink constellation of satellites, that they're putting out enough radiation, and that's one of the other ways that this could happen. I guess no matter whether it's all of these things or a combination of these things, or even old technology, acoustics in the ocean, plus AI, being able to parse massive quantities of data much more fast than we have in the past. We're just off the top of our head, we kind of came up with five of them, and this isn't our day job. So I kind of think that no matter which way it happens, I'm just concerned that it is going to happen. And I think it's going to happen in the next, 5 years. I don't think it's going to take 10 years. And I know it takes our nuclear weapons complex about 10 years to do anything, which I think is another problem. So, I don't know how we can pivot quickly enough. I just think we need to start having these conversations and figuring out what are these next steps that we can reasonably start taking so that we are ready when this becomes operational technology.
Yeah. One of the questions I have, you've thought about this, is where would we start these conversations? Because, you're right. The nuclear community moves extremely slow. So So in the technology community, in the IC community, and I know it's sometimes sensitive to talk about space community. I mean, where do you think the best place to get this conversation rolling and people thinking about this? Obviously, the Navy should be concerned about this, even if it wasn't nuclear Navy, all of the Navy because of the, you know, the submarine fleet, but especially that piece. But I think it's got to get broader than that to get real good coverage and a strategy that's comprehensive.
Yeah. You know, I we're having an election here soon. And we're going to have a different president.
I never heard of that.
And, you know, I think it should really be addressed in this next nuclear posture review when the, you know, the president kind of puts forth the doctrine of the United States and says, hey, this is something that we're going to be taking on. We're going to start planning ahead and we're going to be ready for Transparent Ocean. And we're going to figure out, you know, here's what we're going to at least start strategizing for it and have a, maybe a special committee at STRATCOM or the Pentagon that kind of looks into these issues, looks into the feasibility of these technologies and starts kind of coming up with, you know, plan A and B for how to respond. Yeah. And to your point, I do think that the Navy is the first one that should get involved. I do think that, to Adam's point, putting, you know, nuclear cruise missiles out on other boats, spreading the threat out, I think that's a great idea. And then I kind of also really think that, you know, the triad on a day-to-day basis affects the Air Force and the Navy, right? I think the Air Force should absolutely be part of these discussions. They may take it further because, you know, it's not their tail that's hanging out there. But, you know, Nuke Weapons School would be maybe a good part, a place to have these discussions, at least at a theoretical basis, kind of start that out in, out in Albuquerque. I think mm-hmm. that'd be a great place to talk about it.
No, and I think the national labs also might have the kind of background and also the secrecy to support that. You know, maybe people are working on it that we're not aware of, but it certainly changes the way in which we look at deterrence using that leg of the triad as being that survivable, you know, secretive, come out, just shoot from nowhere. You take that off the plate, and I see instability occurring, which, you know, I think maybe, you know, if Curtis was on here, he'd probably, I'm going to speak on behalf of Curtis. So Curtis, when you hear this, I'm using my best Curtis vision here, but maybe we ought to get the arms control crowd, you know, involved in this because it's going to be, you know, more unstable if we don't have that leg of the triad operating and we want stability. So we should stop this kind of technology development, at least from our adversaries.
Yeah, and I guess, you know, the thing I'll add to that, I think the opposite of what we want to do when we're talking about Transparent Ocean is there's temptation in politics always to go to no first use, right? They always want to go there. And I really think that that is one of the worst missteps that we could take when we're walking into a place where first use nuclear strikes is becoming more and more prevalent, right? So if you don't have a survivable leg or you don't have that secretive leg, it encourages your near peers to have that first strike, right? So unless they're willing to say no first use against, you know, across all countries, and we can kind of come to some kind of safe humanity kumbaya moment, then that'd be great. But, you know, I don't see that happening with all of our peers at once.
Yeah.
I'm concerned, and I don't know if you guys sort of see this, but I'm concerned if you think, maybe I can give you another analogy, Jim, that you understand. If you remember that scene in Star Wars where, you know, Luke and Obi-Wan are going into town and they get stopped by the stormtroopers, and Obi-Wan says, these are not the droids you're looking for. You know, he uses the force on the stormtroopers, and, you know, the stormtroopers, these aren't the droids we're looking for. I fear that we will sort of take this, well, you know, ignore the threat And then, you know, eventually there's, it's almost like an ostrich strategy, you know, stick your head in the sand and ignore it. And I wonder if, you know, we'll do that because we can't gain consensus. We can't, you know, whatever the political maneuvering may be, such that we just say, well, let's ignore it and hope it doesn't become problematic. Or we say, well, we have these other legs and therefore it'll be fine. And then we just are caught with our pants down and we really are in a very difficult position because the people that sort of got us there, this is one of the challenges with politics is no politician is a fiduciary. So you can never put a politician in jail like you can a financial advisor when they give you bad advice or make bad investments for you, or they act in their personal interest and not your interest. We can't do that with politicians. So politicians really have no incentive to get it right because there's really no accountability. And so I wonder how we avoid sort of getting ourselves in a worse position than we're already in relative to our adversaries. Solve that problem, Rob or Jim.
You know, I say it tongue in cheek, and this is not a political endorsement, but, you know, just vote for people that have kids, I guess, you know, like that's the only, you know, at least their kids have to live with the decisions that they make. Right. I don't have an answer for that. I mean, death by committee is always a problem, especially in the United States. So few of our politicians are up to snuff, in my opinion, on nuclear knowledge anyways. They don't really understand what it is. You know, they might want to, you know, defund the Department of Energy because what does that organization do?
Where are the votes there? You know, there's lots of voters. I mean, that's the difficult thing is that defense spending and military systems are, you know, relatively expensive per vote. Whereas, you know, Social Security and extended Medicaid or Medicare or, you know, free college tuition, you can buy a lot of votes with relatively small amounts of money. And so those things are, you know, you incentivize them more because there's a greater, you know, per dollar return for votes than on, you know, a Sentinel, for example.
But I do think that, you know, where we started, and now that we're way off track, but where we started, which was, you know, where do we insert this conversation? Because the conversation has to be inserted somewhere, or as Rob said, we get farther and farther behind and we end up losing the game. And I don't, you know, I say it's a game. It sort of is a game in the part that, you know, people die in the end because you made a mistake, but you lose the game in that your adversary is moving their pieces around. I'm going to use an example here, Adam. You may not have played this game. It's called chess. There's no ball involved. And so that you move a piece in order to position the opposite side, I don't think of the adversary, the other player. You try to position the other player in a place where they can't defend. And that seems to be what's happening. And we need our politicians, but we also need our citizenry, who are the voters, to be aware of the importance of those kind of decisions, so they do put the pressure where it needs to be on the decision makers. And I think that's the piece that I really liked when you wrote us the email and said this would be, I'd like to get involved in this topic, because the idea of getting involved in this topic is to get the conversation started. And my hope is that this organization, the National Institute for Deterrence Studies, and our senior fellows, people like Rob and people like our listeners and people like the extended audience to that, are hearing this and saying, this is important. What more should we do? Why aren't we thinking of this? Rather than 20 years from now saying, why didn't we think of this? It's too doggone late and we keep getting there for all these other reasons. I'm not poo-pooing those away, but I do want to say that's we've got to be that centric part. We've got to start that because no one else is going to do it. Because you're right, Adam. You're not going to get You're not going to grab a vote by simply one person saying this. It's got to be understood that threat that this really presents to us in terms of producing a peaceful world that, you know, has norms and has structure, and that we, you know, can interoperate with other cultures in a way that we are not, you know, killing each other. That's what we don't want to be doing. I don't want to be. It's not a good atmosphere.
Let's look for the most stable, predictable scenario where we all know each other's cards. We all know what's happening, and none of us are incentivized to do a first strike. I think that's really the crux of the position, to your point, Jim.
Yeah.
And that's, I don't know how we get there, but I think you're exactly right. You know, we just need to have these conversations. We need to talk about it. It's a pretty nuanced thing. It's pretty technological. And a lot of people, this may be the first time they've ever heard of Transparent Ocean or the type of problem that this presents. And so for the people in the national labs that are hearing this and they're like, oh yeah, that is a problem. And they're going to think about it and they're going to start introducing ideas and fixes. And so we just got to get it, you know, that knowledge base created first.
Well, I tell you what I'll do to really help push this along. I'm going to reach out to Taylor Swift's people. she's an important political figure who can really make things happen. And once we get all the Swifties on board talking about this topic, I really think we'll get something done. So I think that's what I'll do just for you guys, because I care about you guys.
I'm going to start sewing some sequins onto the back of a jean jacket in the form of a mushroom cloud. And I think that's really going to connect with a lot of that audience.
That's probably true.
I think I'm going to study some electromagnetics, because I think there's something valuable in that.
Now, unfortunately, I guess, or maybe for some listeners, fortunately, we are out of time. And so we'll have to wrap this topic up. So, of course, Rob, thanks for joining us. It was your first time to do it. Hopefully it wasn't too painful. So thanks for coming on the NIDS View.
Absolutely. My pleasure, guys.
Yeah, this has been great, Rob. Nice to meet you sort of virtually here. But people like you is what make NIDS matter, with our contributing members and senior fellows like you. This is a great topic. Thank you.
Great. Happy to come back at some point in the future and talk about more dirty laundry.
Now, of course, we want to thank you, the listeners. And, you know, there's the podcast. There's Global Security Review. You know, we've got HUSC events, so go to the website, thethingdeterrence.com, and check out the HUSC events. There's a lot going on at NIDS, so there's a lot of ways you can engage. You can send us suggestions for topics. You know, we've had listeners come on the show and talk about things before who had interest. So we're always open, and of course, we want to, you know, get out there and educate and inform. So, of course, you know, that's what we do here. Now, to wrap up the show, we've got to always close with our tagline. And so, of course, I want to remind you, the listeners, to always think deterrence.
Thank you for listening to the NIDS View. This show is produced under the NIDS Podcasting Network, a division of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies. NIDS is a 501c3 organization dependent upon donations to provide this podcast and bring about awareness of the peacekeeping value of U.S. strength and our national deterrence. You can catch all of our podcasts or provide feedback at thinkdeterrence.com. I would like to thank our producer, Kimberly Charrington, our sponsors, and all the fantastic members of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies for making this podcast possible. Stay tuned next week for another exciting and informative The NIDS View.